Well, have you had stronger than normal winds in your area in the last few weeks? Did you ever wonder what causes them? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network. We're going to talk about wind, among other things, with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison and a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve, welcome back.
It's great to be back.
And did I get you on there? I think I'm.
Is it on there?
Yeah, it is.
Great to be back.
John Martin's here too. John is a professor in former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John, good to see you
good
again.
To see you, Larry.
Well, why are your these microphones?
I guess you don't want to hear us. Is that what
I had it.
There we go.
Now
you're in.
Now those guys shot. Before us just turned it off.
I tell you what, I have had a cold for the last 5 days, and I think it's affected my functioning a little bit.
It's bad to have a cold on a Thanksgiving.
No, I know. That's
it's not the best time to have it, but I have noticed the wind. And let me give the phone number again, 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can put a note up on our Facebook page. So the wind.
Yeah, you know, it's been windy, but I just spent Thanksgiving in Laramie, Wyoming. And, you know, you want to talk windy.
That's right.
Is windy. It's just open, so not much friction because there's not much plants. And you get winds over the mountains. Will also sometimes as it comes down over the mountains, that downflow will help pick up with the winds as well. They talk about Chicago being the windy city, but I'd go for almost any town east of the Rockies in Wyoming.
Yeah, That's probably right. I think Oklahoma City or Tulsa is actually the windiest town in the U.S.
Really?
I think something in Oklahoma is, but it's the same
something
idea.
Flat.
Open plains, yeah. The wind is, we haven't been that windy around here. We've had moments of heavy wind, but overall, this fall has been stormless.
Yeah.
And the storms are always what bring the wind, so we've been
Is that what brings, how do storms bring the wind?
Well, the distributions in pressure are what really drives the wind, and regions of low pressure can get extremely low, and when they do, the winds can get really strong. It's usually, and they get stronger near the center of such storms, which is just the opposite of anticyclones or high-pressure regions, where the winds get weaker the closer you get to the center of the thing. So we've had a month of October, month of November, that's been dominated by anticyclones across the central U.S., and the consequence is it hasn't been as windy as it probably normally is in November. But this is today, in fact, 22nd anniversary of a really big snowstorm we had here. I remember this one vividly, and it was very windy and very snowy. So, you know, we can get really big storms at this time of year. Just haven't this year.
Well, the wind, I watched 60 Minutes last night, and they did a little piece, a really fine piece, on the Isle of Eigg in Scotland. Mm. And in passing, they mentioned that the winds can get to 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, the upper.
Wow.
The Highlands are really windy, notoriously windy places in the Scottish Highlands and the Hebrides, the islands off there. Incredible. Yeah. I would love to go there for a windstorm. And you could go almost any time of the year during the cold season and see one. Yeah.
And that's pretty flat as well. I mean, the thing that slows down the wind is friction. If you have open plains like Wyoming or the parts of northern Scotland that I've been to are also pretty highland, but not big trees and things like that.
One of the women they were interviewing happened to mention, she said, it's really interesting when you open your mouth into 100 mile an hour wind.
I bet it is. You evacuate your lungs if you're turned the wrong way.
Hopefully no dust or leaves or other things are blowing around.
You got to keep your mouth shut when you're in the wind. You don't want to open your mouth in 100 mile an hour wind. Yeah, that's our word of wisdom today.
Yeah, man.
If you happen to be in 100 mile an hour wind, keep your mouth closed. Oh, man. So temperatures, changing temperatures, do they affect how often we see high winds or...
Indirectly, I think it's probably safe to say that when, you know, seasonal temperature changes come along with the migration of the jet stream, which is kind of connected to the development of the very weather systems that bring the heavy winds when they occur. So there's that connection, but it's somewhat indirect, I think it's safe to say. You know, you could, at any given time of the year, if the temperature changes rather dramatically, it may be associated with the passage of a storm. And so, therefore, it looks like the temperature has something to do with the wind, but it's just kind of coming along for the ride.
Yeah. Well, speaking of temperatures, the last month We're right now, we're in a pretty warm, at least in parts of Wisconsin. But
yeah, but
what's it been like for the month?
That's only recent.
Yeah, because you know, yeah. We had some cold.
We did for Madison anyway through Thursday, so through Thanksgiving Day, in anticipation of a really warm Friday, which we did. We had a record high on Friday, the 63 degrees. We were 5.6 degrees below normal for the month of November up through the 23rd. And
most of southern Wisconsin was that way.
Yeah, right. That's
most
not
of the
isolated.
The state was below.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we'll end up below normal, but we will take a little bit of the bite out of that this last week, which is going to be a little bit warmer than normal, I think.
Yeah, highs in the 50s
today will be very warm.
Southern Wisconsin.
It's not 50 right now, though, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, I'm going to walk over here.
No, it was kind of chillier than that, but it's not bad.
Do we know what December is going to be like?
I looked at the monthly forecast that's put out by NOAA, and it was kind of interesting because in temperature wise, you know, it's kind of like a flip of the coin. It could, you know, be equal chances of above normal, normal or below normal. But what was interesting is they had precipitation, a greater probability to be above normal.
Oh, wow,
in Wisconsin, which was kind of odd, not being, because usually, you know, the stronger statistical signature is in the temperature, not in the precipitation.
Yeah, right. That's very interesting. Yeah. That's a really.
And I think it may be that there's a La Nina developing, which.
And what's that one again?
That is the one that it's not as strong as a connection. It's what happens in the Pacific Ocean in terms of the ocean temperatures and how they flip around, and that changes the global circulation. For us in an El Nino year, which is the opposite of a La Nina, usually it brings less snowfall for Wisconsin. La Nina, the signal is not as strong
that's
in the
right.
Great Lake
yeah.
regions. So that's
right.
why I was kind of surprised that they were going above normal in precipitation.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, as the end of October came around, it was notable that there was anomalous snow cover in central Canada, which goes hand in hand with a fairly cold first few weeks in November. And what's been happening during November has been we haven't had much wind. As we mentioned before, we haven't had a lot of storms, but the storms that have come across the continent have come across right along the Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan border with Canada. So there's been an enhancement of the snow in southern Canada. So I don't know what December is going to bring, but I can tell you this. I have a feeling that it's going to be, there's going to be cold air lurking just north of us throughout the month. So if we get a turn of the winds from the north, we're going to get cold. And that's what it's been much of November.
And this is kind of what you forecast in October. I'll give you credit for that.
Thank you.
October it was above normal, and you kept saying that cold air is building. And when it comes to November, comes down here in November, it's going to seem really cold.
Yeah. And yeah, we're only 3 or 4 degrees below normal, and it does seem
it
cold. Everyone's
really
already
cold.
Complaining about the winter.
And so, and you know, I think the same kind of holds true a little bit for the wind, too, because if you don't get a lot of wind and then you get some wind, it's
gosh,
it's windy.
Right, you're not testifying to the average. You're testifying to what just happened. Yeah, that's right.
And you tend to also testify not to the average, but the things that happen that are above or below.
Yeah, that's
average,
right.
What you remember.
And mostly above. It's mostly,
mostly above, it's
the above average wind.
That's right.
Nobody remembers no wind.
No.
Unless they're a sailor.
Right.
They're upset.
Yeah, right. Stuck on the lake.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, our guests. If you have a weather or climate question, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Where do you go to get your weather forecasts?
I go to the National Weather Service.
Yeah.
You know, when I'm looking around here, I go to the Sullivan office. Mm. They have a nice discussion of what the forecast is. If I'm out of town, a lot of times, and I just want something really quick, I'll go to this site called Weather Underground. Mm. They usually have a pretty good summary of what the, you know, current or the day outlook is, as well as the 10-day outlook.
Yeah,
I don't believe the 10-day outlook, but I believe that, you know,
the
3 days
season,
that I'm there.
It's more worth looking at in the cold season. Than
it's getting better. It's getting a lot better.
This is what weather bug. Do you ever look at the weather bug?
You know, I used to when I was, this is probably about 8 years ago. They approached us about buying one of their weather stations. And so then I started tracking it and looking at them, because that's a lot of home stuff as well.
Yeah. Well, that's one I've got an app of. So
that's right. <yeah.
laughs> So let's push that one. Donna in Arcadia has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Donna.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was talking to some of my family over Thanksgiving, and I'm curious about something. We're about a month away from the winter solstice, and the 21st is the darkest day of the year. The sun is weak in the sky, low in the sky. And I'm trying to figure out why our temperatures aren't symmetrical around the solstice. Why on November 21st we don't have the same kind of weather temperatures we would expect on January 21st.
Mm. That's a good question.
And why on October 21st the temperatures aren't anything like they are in February 21st.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is an interesting question.
Excellent question. Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry, Larry.
Well, I think we're going to have to... Donna, you can hang on if you'd like to. We're going to take a little pause, though, first, before we answer that question. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, John Martin, professor and former chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Our guests, they'll be back, and we'll take up that question right after the news. Well, great to have you along here on the Ideas Network. Strange newscast. I think it was the wind or something. Maybe it was something going on there. Oh, John Martin, Steve Ackerman with us, our weather guys, talking climate and weather with them. And you can join in with your weather question. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page. Donna from Arcadia wonders, well, maybe you guys can describe it for me.
Yeah, she had a really good question. She wondered why, since the winter solstice is at the end of December, 21st of December, why are the temperatures for the year not symmetric around their low point, which one might expect to be on the 21st of December? Mm-hmm. And so, in other words, I guess they were talking at Thanksgiving a month before, approximately. Why is not the temperature around Thanksgiving Day quite like it is at the end of January? Because that's about a month away on both sides of December 21st. Great question, and it has to do with the way energy is transferred in the atmosphere. December 21st is definitely the day where the incoming radiation is at its minimum for every location in the Northern Hemisphere. But it's not the day where the outgoing radiation is at its maximum. And so it's the difference between those two that you have to kind of balance to figure out how cold you get. So Steve knows this is his expertise. He's better guy to talk about it than me.
Yeah, and it's a great Thanksgiving conversation compared to some other conversations one might have. Right. Talk about the weather. Why not? But yeah. And, you know, it's the same thing. It's about energy gains versus energy losses. And on December 21st, we are losing more energy than we're gaining, and so we do cool down, but we keep cooling down until January. That imbalance occurs until late January. It's the same reason during even the daily cycle, where you might expect to have the highest temperatures at noon, because that's when the sun is highest in the sky, and therefore you get the highest total amount of energy per square meter or per square foot. But our peak temperatures don't occur until like 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Because the opposite's going on there. You're gaining more energy past noontime than you're losing until the ground heats up.
Until the ground heats up enough that you can lose it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you got oceans and you got snow that starts to fall. That exacerbates the amount of energy that's lost. It's great. You know, that all works together.
There you go, Donna.
All right.
Is that what you all concluded in your Thanksgiving dinner?
I wish we were so smart.
Yeah, well, it's like cooking turkeys. It's energy gains versus losses.
We all gave up and had more to eat.
There you go.
It's a good fallback.
Right. Thanks, Donna.
Thank you.
All right. Appreciate the call. And Uncle Harry didn't hit Uncle Don with a turkey leg.
Yeah, right.
Jay and Sun Prairie, hi.
Hi, I'm interested in some discussion about the October 24th storm about a month ago on Lake Superior, with some of the pretty awesome waves and wind damage around Marquette, where I'm happen to be from. A term came up called bombogenesis, which I'd never heard of before until just the storm happened. So there'd be some discussion about that storm, if possible.
Yeah, I don't recall that event directly because I think it was just on the border. It was mostly a Canadian event, although it did, of course, affect the lake being so close to Canada. Bombogenesis is just a term that is used in our science kind of casually, but not without meaning. And a bomb is a storm that deepens extremely rapidly, as much as 12 millibars of central pressure fall within 12 hours. And so this storm that you're talking about was probably an example of that kind of rapid development. And such rapid development at the surface induces, kind of our topic of the day, induces really, really strong surface winds. And near Lake Superior or on the lake, those surface winds kick up enormous waves. They can be sometimes 25 feet high or greater even in the fall and winter before the ice gets on there. And so perfect time of the year for that kind of a big event, and that's probably the kind of storm you had. They're relatively rare, although not entirely absent, but they're much more common over the ocean than they are over the continent, and including, when I say that, I'm including the lakes. So they're not so common over the continent. They're always of interest to me.
So I always thought, and I could be totally wrong, that when you talk about these bombs, they're frequently on the east coast, so around the boundaries between land and
that is true.
The Gulf Stream.
That's where they predominantly occur, in both in the Pacific Basin along the Kuroshio Current off Japan and then off the Gulf Stream Current off the east coast of the United States. But they're not unprecedented in inland.
And inland?
They're robbed of some of the same ingredients that make them so strong in those oceanic regions when they occur inland. So they have to have something else working for them, and it's usually a really intense upper-level disturbance.
So do you think that lake temperature versus the land temperature had a role in this one?
Probably not. The lakes are huge, but they're not on
the
cyclone scale. They're just not on that scale. So they don't do any damage to the development. Certainly probably enhance it a little bit, but probably not to the point where you get that kind of an extreme event just because there's lakes there, because they don't happen every year. There's a good example of why.
Did you get snowfall with that, Jay?
From what I understand, no. There was not snowfall. There was tremendous winds. The waves that you mentioned, there was, I believe, a 27-foot wave recorded at a place called Standard Rock. That's pretty much due north of Marquette out in the lake. Standard Rock is literally a rock with a lighthouse built on it. It's quite an interesting history in itself. But the apparently that at that place there was a 27-foot wave, I believe. The winds were somewhere in the neighborhood of 77. I don't know if it was knots or miles per hour. Big wave.
Yeah,
big,
pretty amazing. Yeah.
And the storm was, I guess, considered probably bigger than the storm that took out the Edmund Fitzgerald 40-some years ago. It was a real big storm, and especially big for a native of Marquette who is in constant awe of that lake. Some of the videos on YouTube are kind of amazing. You might want to Google that sometime.
Yeah, we'll have to take a look. 27 feet, just think about a wave coming at you.
And I think it's true when they talk about these significant wave heights, that's one half of the wave, okay? So you're talking about the crest and the ridge added together is 54 feet.
Ouch.
So when you talk about a 27-foot wave, keep that in mind.
You're in the trough.
Multiply by two. It's amazing.
Thank you. October 24th was the date.
Yeah, I'll take a look at that again.
Thank you, Jay, for calling. Appreciate it very much. Well, Bob in Fitchburg has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Hi, guys. I was wondering if you could talk in layman's terms to explain why a high-pressure system builds pressure and why a low-pressure system loses pressure.
Okay.
Yeah, it's another really great fundamental question, one that was not really understood until probably the late 1930s, to be honest with you. And it has to do, as you might guess, with the weight of the air. And so the air actually weighs something, even though you can wave your hand through it as if it weren't there. It actually weighs something, and that weight is manifest in the way we record the pressure. And so if the pressure at a location fluctuates, let's say that it goes down, what that means is that the column of air that sits above that location weighs less at that instant than it did an hour previous to that time. And if the pressure goes up, it's just the opposite, that the weight of the air above that column has gone up. The way that that can happen is you can actually, to make the pressure lower, you can take air out of that column and displace it to some other location. And the way that you do that is you have vertical motions that are going upwards through the troposphere and evacuating air out of that column. And then you're kind of filling in adjacent columns with regions of with that excess air, and as a consequence, the pressure rises in those locations. So highs and lows are a function of the presence of waves in the middle and upper troposphere that actually assist in evacuating mass out of some columns and stuffing it back into other ones. So it's as simple as that, even though understanding how that works is more complicated. But it really is exactly, there's less weight in that, there's less mass in that column when the pressure is lower.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Paul in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I have a question about what's the effect of La Nina on the weather of the Gulf Coast, say from New Orleans on the west over to Tallahassee on the east. I like to vacation in that part of the world in winter, and I was just wondering what to expect.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think the biggest signal in the continental U.S. with regard to La Nina is in the northwest part of the country. So I'm trying to, in my mind, I'm visualizing these maps of where you see the impact, and I don't think there's much of a statistical significance in the southeast U.S.
It's opposite for El Nino, where it's wetter there as a result. But it's not, you're right that there's no particularly strong signal, rather like what we have here in the Great Lakes states. It's up in the air, so one can't say with any, you know.
So go vacation.
Yeah.
You continue to do so.
Should be all right, Paul.
Yeah, it shouldn't be excessively rainy.
Right.
And if you get blown out of the off the road, why, call us back. And
that's right.
Caveat emptor, Paul.
But should be okay. Should be okay. Thanks, Paul.
You'll be warmer than what it is up here. That I will
that's for sure.
Go for.
Annie in Watertown, it's your turn. Hi, Annie. Thank you for calling.
Well, my question is, I have been wondering about how an official determination of what a temperature is. Because, like, in the morning on the east side, the patio will be 60 degrees, where really the high for the day is 40, or I'll get 40 degrees in the middle of winter from the thermometer that's on the west side because the sun hits it. In the summer, it's under the shade tree, and it'll be, you know, different. So how exactly do you determine a temperature?
That is a great question. A lot of really good questions.
Well, what's going on?
Why are you so smart?
Eating something. What did everybody have for Thanksgiving dinner? I got to get some of that.
That's an excellent question because, as you could just look outside and see where frost forms and where it doesn't and know that the temperature difference must have been different over the night. And so the National Weather Service has very strict rules in terms of making the temperatures that are going to go into their weather forecast models or into their climate records. And so there are very distinct definitions of where the observations can be made. They're made at a certain height. They're made in what's called a Stevenson screen. So it is like a white shelter with louver doors on it, if you will, so that it keeps it from direct sunlight, because that will also affect the temperature, but also allows wind to blow it, so you actually get mixing. And then it's got to be out in an open field, so there isn't any kind of shading or anything that falls on it as well. So, there's a lot of variation in the temperature just by shading of objects or by winds or by calmness around objects. And for that reason, the National Weather Service has really strict rules of how to make those official temperatures.
Yeah, and if you want to mimic that and get a fairly accurate measurement at your own location throughout the year, you might just put your thermometer someplace where it never sees direct sunlight and that it's relatively well protected from the wind. And if you do those two things, you do pretty well getting a reasonably accurate measure.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
and
thanks.
Then the height is what, 3 meters.
3 meters. Feet, 3 meters. Something like that, yeah.
Oh, there we go. Thank you, Annie. Great question. Appreciate it. Do you have a question for us? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, and we'll get you on pretty quickly, so give a call. Kenneth in Janesville had actually called and couldn't hang on. Wonders if the wobble in the Earth's rotation affects weather patterns.
That's a good question. In weather patterns that Kenneth and I will observe in our lifetimes, the answer is categorically no, because that wobble is over tens of thousands of years. But over those periods of time, that such a wobble affects the climate boundary conditions, and those boundary conditions affect the weather systems that parade across the continent. So there's bound to, the answer has to be yes in the long term. But in a lifetime of a human being or the lifetime of a family of human beings over generations, the answer is no.
Oh, interesting. We've got some more callers coming on online here, so we'll take some calls at 800-642-1234. I hope you'll give us a call. Tony in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call.
Well, I've had a question in my head for some time after that big one. I can't remember the names anymore, but it came from the east.
Hurricane.
Yeah, big. Mm. Came from the east and hit the hot water in the Florida Straits.
Mm.
And I know that's a very deep body of water, and I saw it there at like 89 degrees. And I have this feeling that in all of physics, sort of like a body in motion tends to stay in motion, now unless it's augmented by some other force. Now, there's many forces that you guys know a lot more about than I do. But what interested me about this was it hit that body of water and went right straight through the straits, and yet it took an absolute right turn and headed straight up the west coast of Florida. And I don't quite understand why it did that as opposed to just being a little more out into the Gulf a little more.
Yeah, that's a great question. And another
Tony,
one.
Another one. What's going on here? There's some kind of conspiracy, but it's great. You bring up a really interesting couple of factors that influence hurricane destruction. One of them is how intense they get, and that is directly related to how warm the surface temperature of the ocean is. Not only the surface temperature, but how deep does the warm water go? So something known as ocean heat content is now becoming more trusted measure, or at least added to a list of trusted measures for how you can get ready for one of these storms and intensify.
That's why the Florida Straits is such a tough spot.
That's correct. It's very, very warm, and it's usually very deep. In fact, that's a place where you can get deep, warm water over a very short period of time as the summertime progresses. So it's a spot where if a hurricane finds it, it's going to definitely benefit from that. Whether or not that has an influence on its track is not well understood. In fact, if I had to make a guess, I'd say no, there are other environmental factors that drive the track that you mentioned about it going up through the Everglades and then the west coast of Florida. That's probably not a function of just the oceanic heat content or nor the surface water temperature. It's some other environmental factor.
I don't think it is either, but I couldn't figure out why it would do it. I mean, it almost looked like, you know, Donald said, screw up the other side.
It's hard to know. I don't, you know, people who are studying that, there was a big NSF push right after the hurricanes to kind of do some work on some of this very stuff.
At least I'm at some sort of leading edge.
Yeah, you
well,
are.
I'll keep watching.
Yeah, people are trying to understand that better.
But it is, as you're pointing out, though, there is a force that's coming in, and we may not be able to predict it, that's causing it to move and not continue in a straight line.
Yeah.
Well, I'd rather live at a time in history where we can't predict everything.
That's true.
That's a good point, Tony. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, boy. Ed in Madison has a question. Hi, Ed.
Hi. Yeah, I've got a quick two-part question. First of all, am I correct? The official Madison temperature is taken at the Dane County Regional Airport?
That is correct.
Okay. And I've always understood, I know the airport's in a former swamp, and it's quite low. Has that any effect on the actual official temperature? In other words, maybe it's because cold air tends to settle in lower spots.
Mm-hmm.
Does that influence the temperature they take at the airport?
Yeah, it sure does. The way the question came across on our record is, are the measurements there accurate? They're accurate, but they're not representative.
Yeah, they're accurate of the airport.
Yeah, right.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it's not uncommon for any resident of Madison to look up, you know, if he or she is interested in the weather and kind of on a cold morning, look at the official reading, the minimum overnight temperature, and find that it's like 6 or 10 degrees colder than what they got at their house. It's not that your thermometer is wrong. It's that they're taking a measurement at the airport, which is a low-lying area, and exactly for the reasons you said, it gets colder than most other places overnight on a cold night.
Is that also relevant when it's summer?
Yeah, it'll even do that, yeah. Especially on the kind of, if everybody's going to have a relatively cool, foggy night, then it'll definitely register at the airport even in the summer,
If it's even a nice, calm night.
And I have a weather radio. The temperature reports on there by the hour, is that taken from the airport?
I believe the answer is yes, yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess that's clear enough. Thank you very much.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for calling. Tom in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Good afternoon, actually. My question is about hoar frost.
Okay.
What conditions precede hoar frost? Because I always get up in the morning and I see the hoar frost, and I'd love to take pictures of it, but I can't because I don't have my camera with me.
Yeah.
What I'd be looking for the night before in the forecast to say maybe I should take my camera with me.
I would look at two things, and this is assuming that you're not going to get a fog form. Which, you know, can make its own beauty in terms of the freezing frog then hitting objects, is I would look at whether or not it's going to be a calm night and what the dew point is. In terms of, one, is it below freezing and how close is it to the air temperature? Because what you want to do is to get, at nighttime, the air temperature is going to cool down. And if the dew point is below freezing and it's, you know, within a couple of degrees, say 4 or 5 degrees of the air temperature, then you'll get condensation.
Okay.
Because that is so beautiful. And every time I've seen it and wanted to photograph it, I don't have my camera with me.
That's usually the way it goes with weather observations and, for example, rainbows, right?
No kidding.
You see the most beautiful rainbows when you don't have a camera.
We're hoping that people's cell phones will start to erode some of that frustration because it's a little bit more handy, perhaps, but it's not the best picture sometimes.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom. Yeah, appreciate the call. Hank in Milwaukee, on to you now. Hi, Hank.
Yes, hi there. Say, I had a question. Your guests were saying that when you're placing your home thermometer, you should be concerned about having it in a windy area, but the wind wouldn't affect the temperature.
He wonders if you broke up there, Hank. So he wonders, does wind affect temperature, or why does it?
He's got a good point there, because I said that with regard to the Stevenson screen, is that it's a white shelter that keeps the sun from being shining directly on the thermometer, but it's got louver doors so the wind can move through it. And that was probably a misstatement. Really, what those louver doors do is they don't trap the air so that it heats up and then stays inside. It actually can get outside and ventilate outside of that area.
Yeah. And the reason, though, and this is a really good question again. Wow, what a day.
Doggone it.
We should be
writing these down for qualifying exams.
I know. You know, if you're in a rain event or a snow event and it's windy and your thermometer is subject to that wind, maybe the thermistor gets hit by raindrops or pieces of ice or something like that, and that does have an effect on how the thing registers the temperature of the air, because it's mistakenly registering the temperature of the raindrop or the temperature of the ice for a moment, maybe longer than that if it really gets piled up. So, yeah, Steve's right. It's ventilation that matters, but if you're out in the wind, you might even get some of those other effects that aren't positive.
Now, on the other hand, also you have the wind chill temperature. What the wind does is it allows things to cool down faster. So it won't change the air temperature, but if you take something like a human body and go outside on a windy day, you'll cool down a lot faster to the air temperature.
Yep, there we go. Thank you so much, Hank. Appreciate it. And Tim and Eau Claire, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. One quick question, and then if it's okay, just a second real quick one. How far hurricanes, obviously they go hurricanes, tropical storms, tropical depressions, but how far into the U.S. is the farthest we've seen one push? And then my second real quick question is, I see two types of fog. I see fog that is settled on the ground, and then I see fog that is settled maybe 5 or 6 or 8 feet up in the air, to me, different types of fog. Low-lying clouds versus almost something that seems to come from the ground. Is there a name for those?
Two really good questions. I don't know how far inland it goes. Probably not far,
right?
Unless the ground is really wet.
And it depends on what you're talking about too. And I know this is going to be technical and probably dicing things beyond what we need, but if you drop below hurricane category 1 status, the distance, like Steve says, is not that great. But tropical storms that have used to be hurricanes can make it well inland, all the way to, you know, Cape Girardeau, Missouri, if they come through the Gulf of Mexico. So several hundred miles, and retain a circulation and an intensity that, at least meets tropical storm standards. So depends on exactly what kind of storm you're talking about. But they can have an impact hundreds of miles inland from the coast of the United States.
And fog, that's a really good question.
Because
I usually think of fog, or as my quick definition is, it's a cloud in contact with the ground.
Yeah.
And yet those ones, that, and you see them frequently, you know, that are You know, 5-10 feet above the ground. I still call a fog. It's driven by the same processes.
And I've heard people specifically refer to ground fog, but no other specification for any other kind, including the kind that's 5 or 10 feet above the ground. Yeah. So I wonder if there just isn't, there's no difference, as you point out, but it testifies to how much variation there is in the water vapor content of the air and various other things on very fine scales. Yeah. But ground fog might be the way you designate one of them. Yeah.
Well, I feel like I'm doing a famous show and getting kicked off the stage.
Well, it is a famous show. It's the Weather Guy show. You know, that's right. Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, John Martin, they'll be back on January 29th. That's the last Monday in January. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Christmas is on a Monday, so I think you guys are doing something else.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In the meantime, thank you so much for listening. And please stay with us. We've got lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.